As we continue this reflection and exploration, it is, I think, really vitally important that we bear in mind the context of this teaching. You know, that the Buddha's primary concern was the understanding of dukkha and the origins of dukkha and the bringing of it to an end. The Buddha said that this teaching really only has one taste, which is the taste of freedom. And the Buddha's orientation and direction and teaching was pretty much solely concerned with awakening, with the liberation of the heart. And he saw this as being really a possibility for all who were sincerely willing to undertake the path and to kind of set their feet upon the path. He didn't make exclusions, he didn't make exemptions. I think what excludes anyone from the path of liberation is actually the attachment to non-liberation, which is curious. But that is actually what sustains dukkha, is the attachment to non-liberation. So the Buddha actually portrays many, many pathways, as I said yesterday, and all of them are actually pathways that are asked to be embodied, not just thought about, reflected on, but actually asked to be cultivated and practiced. And when we look at this particular template of awakening, we're looking at two aspects. One aspect is the cultivation and the path, and the other aspect is the fruition or the realization. These, by the way, cannot be separated. They cannot be separated. So the stream entry, you know, this very deep, unshakable understanding of the emptiness of personality view, the cessation of doubt and the cessation of the attachment to habits, basically. This is not born of simply listening to the teachings, but actually, of course, trying this out in one's own experience, you know, really turning this teaching into a pathway of practice. There are said to be, I mean, there's often, I think in the Buddhist teaching, is a pretty comprehensive map, you know, because certainly it begins with ethics always. Every template, every map begins with integrity, because this is actually to take the first step on the path. You know, it's to take the first step on the path. And it's not just liberation from dukkha, it's also liberation to, the freedom to be an embodied, caring, compassionate, dynamic, alive, creative, responsive human being. This is actually what is the liberation to. So, as well as ethics, in this particular template, the Buddha puts down four factors necessary for stream entry realization. The first of these is to associate with the wise. To associate with the wise, now we can discuss that a little bit in a minute. The second is to hear the Dharma. The third is wise attention. And the fourth is to practice the Dharma. Now, all of these are kind of very much co-joined, I would say. To associate with the wise, I mean, what does the Buddha really mean by this? Does he mean that we're going to go through life, you know, being so selective with our relationships that we're deeming who is wise and who is unwise and, you know, who we're not going to talk to and, you know, who we're not going to relate to? I don't think so. But the Buddha did recognize, you know, that there's a certain infectiousness to greed, anger, and delusion. You know, it is a little bit infectious, isn't it? I mean, if we only hang out, you know, with, you know, in conversations and relationships where our primary attention is on how we're going to fulfill our cravings, you know, it does make a certain imprint on the mind, doesn't it? if we hang out, choose to hang out in places and relationships where, you know, the primary thread is hatred or aversion, it's hard to imagine that doesn't make something of an impact or an imprint on our mind. You know, so the Buddha's talking here about making choices. I mean, none of us wants to be into this holier than thou kind of path or practice, you know, where we're constantly, you know, kind of seeing who we're going to allow into our world and who's worthy. That's not what the Buddha was talking about at all. But he's actually talking about, I think, the infectiousness of greed, hatred, and delusion, and where we actually really choose to actually spend our time and associate with. That's why I think so much emphasis really was placed upon Sangha. You know, just as there's an infectiousness to greed, hatred, and delusion, I think there is also a certain infectiousness to goodwill and kindness and, you know, love of clarity and ethics, you know. So this is, I think, is quite a, it's a fairly big question. I mean, I'm sure it's true for you as it is for me. You know, I certainly cannot determine or even want to determine who comes into my world and my life and, you know, how I relate to people on the street I've never met. I never want to have that kind of mind. But, you know, it's a difference. Do I sort of hang out in the bar or do I come here? You know, it's kind of like, it's kind of those kind of choices, you know. What actually are we absorbing and recognizing? Sometimes we have choices about what we absorb, and what is being imprinted on the mind. But some he said, you know, those who associate with who hang out in unwise situations, he likened it to the ladle that's never going to taste the soup. You know, it's kind of like that kind of analogy he used. I think it is quite a big question, actually. You know, we don't, any of us, just practice or walk this path alone. You know, we need allies, we need inspiration, we need support, we need encouragement, you know. We need good friends who are truly not looking at us in terms of what they can get from us or need from us or want from us. We actually do rely upon, I think, the generosity of good friends, of Sangha. A second of these to hear the Dharma, and I think I spoke about this at the beginning yesterday, that this is one of the primary steps of insight, to have that willingness to continually learn. You know, to learn, to actually be a student of Nirvana, to learn, to listen, to reflect, to actually allow new information and perspectives and possibilities into some of the closed circuits of our consciousness. Wise attention, yanaso manasakara, this is a huge area. I think one of the greatest gifts of mindfulness, and I see this both in contemporary mindfulness situations and classical ones, the greatest gift of mindfulness is the discovery that we can choose what we attend to and how. In this moment, I can choose whether I attend to the touch of my foot on the ground or to some fantasy that might arise. I can choose actually what I attend to. I can also choose how I attend. There's so much actually placed on this development of wise attention as a sort of guardian of the mind. It's a guardian of the mind. You know, I can choose, I discover, whether to be lost in rumination or actually to come back and attend to the body. I can actually, if there's enough mindfulness present, I can choose whether I'm going to sort of, you know, feed an attachment to habits, or actually whether I'm going to listen wholeheartedly to the sound of a bird outside the window. You know, there are so many ways in which unwise attention is one of the ways that is actually fueling the perpetuation and the continuation of the very things that actually cause distress. This is a skill. This is a craft. This is something that we practice, that we explore, that we examine, where our attention is actually resting in any given moment and how. One of the definitions the Buddha gave of wise attention is not grasping at the sense impression or the associations with it. That's a useful one to explore. Sense impressions are part of our every moment. You know, the sounds, the sights, the sensations, the thoughts, the tastes, the touches. You know, every moment in our lives we're flooded with sense impressions. Not grasping at the sense impression or the associations with it. I mean, we can see so clearly that the root of this grasping is, you know, do I like it or I don't like it? You know, do I want it or not want it? How is this serving me, Lena? How is this serving my sense of security and control and pleasure? Or how does it seem to threaten that? So not grasping at the sense impression or the associations with it. It's actually not grasping at, oh yes, you know, here's that sound of the bird, you know, and I had such a lovely vacation last year filled with birds, you know, and I'd like some more birds, you know, and maybe I'll bring my bird book, you know. And you can see that grasping at the sense impression, the associations with it, is such a trigger for constantly bringing the past into the present. Constantly repeating how we have seen something before and beginning to actually build the narratives in the present that actually become the sort of history of the next time we hear that bird. You know how it keeps us locked into my world, my way of seeing. So the Buddha spoke about this development of wise attention as a very clear cultivation in every moment of sense impression. It's beginning to explore the domain of that habit pattern of clinging. It's beginning to explore the domain of the habit patterns of craving and aversion. And it's beginning to explore the domain of what I make something mean. What I make something mean to me. You know, that because of my associations and the liking, the disliking, I make that bird mean something to me, you know, something intrinsically to be sought after or pursued. It's constantly learning to step out of the world of fabricating, the world of fabrication. I mean, you think about this in terms of your own experience, you know, you have a sensation in your body, perhaps you've had a history of illness. You know, and the sensation of your body immediately gets, with unwise attention, gets filtered through that lens of association, you know. Oh, maybe it means I'm getting sick again. You know, what will that mean to me? You know, it'll be like this, it'll be like that. We can see we're immediately into that fabrication, you know. Perhaps you have a memory arise, you know, an image arise of someone you've struggled with, and how easily the mind is just taking hold of that and feeding the associations in and actually rebuilding that world of distress. You know, when the Buddha says distress is created and recreated, the world of distress is built and rebuilt, often on the ground of unwise attention. You know, it's why so much, you know, you see so often in the teaching, you know, in the seeing, just the seeing, in the hearing, just the hearing. You know, in the thinking, just the thinking, in the sensing, just the sensing, rather than building a world of fabrication, of construction. It's learning to step off those wheels. This is a real training. You know, we actually practice wise attention, and, you know, part of it is restraint, part of it is understanding of knowing where this goes. you know, part of it is a way of actually caring for the well-being of our mind. You know, to actually, it's a psychological hygiene, you know. It's caring for the well-being of our mind, of developing a mind that is actually truly a friend. And we have to be so clear that, you know, the tendency of practicing unwise attention, it doesn't have a conscience. You know, we might think, well, it doesn't really matter, the bird story, you know, it's pretty benign, you know, it doesn't really do any harm to anyone. The harm is in the habit pattern. The harm is in the habit pattern of continually perpetuating unwise attention, because, yes, in one sense, of course, it's totally benign, the bird narrative, but it's exactly the same habit pattern that's going to seize upon the difficult, seize upon the troublesome, seize upon the ill will, you know, seize upon the anxiety. So actually we're learning, actually as a training, to develop this carefulness of how we attend and where we attend, moment to moment in our experience. The Buddha very much links this into the awakening process, you know, links this into the realization of stream entry, you know, of truly seeing the emptiness of personality view, the cessation of doubt, the cessation of attachment, because all of these are fabrications in which unwise attention is actually implicated. But this is not an easy training, I have to say that, but it's also not complex. Because we're actually developing wise attention, usually in the midst of unwise attention. So it's not an easy training, because it's constantly swimming against the tide of psychological habit. The habits of proliferation, the habits of dwelling, the habits of clinging, the habits of storytelling. So we're actually developing wise attention in that classroom, which actually makes it actually quite a challenging, but also a very interesting training. You know, because we do have such an addiction at times to fabricating. You know, that it's sometimes hard to convince ourselves that, you know, there might be a better way of attending in this moment. You know, and that maybe this is unhelpful, and maybe all that fabricating is actually obscuring our capacity for genuine wakefulness. Because when we're fabricating, we're building personality view. You know, when we're fabricating, we're often building the world of what I know, you know. We're often building the narratives of doubt. We're often building the, you know, reinforcing the habit patterns of attachment. So this is a huge terrain, I think, to explore. But it's also, again, it's like all of the other practices in this map. It's like the raw material's already here. You know, we don't have to wait for the right moment to practice wise attention. You know, there's always the right moment to practice wise attention. And it's actually taking care, you know, this is one of the sort of the first building block of mindfulness. You know, because this is not the same as mindfulness. This is the first building block of mindfulness. And it's what allows the other building blocks to actually develop. Anybody have any reflections about any of these four, of associating with the wise, hearing the Dharma, wise attention, of course, the fourth is actually practicing this. Actually practicing this. Yeah. Regret or how much attention to give to... Well, I mean, as we all know, you know, meditative practice is often a practice, a process of unlayering, isn't it? Where, you know, sometimes we become a little bit more intimate than we would always like with domains of regret. You know, I think it's good to recognize that in Buddhist psychology, there is such a thing as wholesome shame. And it's actually quite encouraged. It's seen as a virtue. And personally, I think there's a great shortage of it in our world. It It's interesting because, we have such an allergy to the word shame, don't we? Because we only ever see it in a very negative light. But in Buddhist psychology, it's hiri otapa. Hiri and otapa. It's actually both a wholesome shame and actually a commitment to not repeating the origins of wholesome shame. That wholesome shame is more of a present tense experience, but it can be a present tense experience that arises in thoughts about things that have gone by, And wholesome shame, I think we probably all recognize it. When you've said something or done something, you just kind of go, oh no, It's that sort of from the Tibetan, it's called becoming red faced. Mm-hmm. It's almost like an energetic somatic thing, isn't it? You just go, oh, and then afterwards, I really wish I hadn't said that, I really wish I hadn't done that. And the Buddha calls it a wholesome shame because it's often pointing to moments where we've become a little bit disconnected from our ethical compass, and we know it. And we know it. And so the otapa part is a commitment to actually reorienting towards that ethical compass. So actually when thoughts about the past arise, where there has been, suddenly there's this sense of wholesome shame about it, regret. It's again, the wise attention here is not about, going into the narrative and reliving it and, if only and I shouldn't have. I think the wise attention in that moment is probably the ethical reorientation and commitment. I think that would be the wise attention part.
Mm-hmm. Orienting and going into that sense of
mind. I mean, I think that this particular map of these four steps is really, it's actually cultivating the conditions that incline the mind towards awakening. It's actually recognizing that, awakening is not some isolated independent of conditions. It's actually cultivating the conditions that incline the mind towards understanding, incline the mind towards awakening. And I do think this is really important because, I think for many people in Western culture, it is about practice and it's not necessarily all about life. And how we live our lives and the choices we make in our lives. And, I think from the perspective of the teaching, the Buddha talked about a path of awakening that includes much more than what we do on a cushion, and how many people in the West feel some frustration, about this separation between what happens on the cushion and what happens off. And here the Buddha's really valuing what happens off, What happens off the cushion, how we're actually cultivating and making choices in our lives about actually what helps the mind to incline towards awakening as being, absolutely an essential investigation, that it's not just about sitting more. It's about actually bringing into being those conditions that really almost keep reminding us almost of what we're prone to forget, And how easily we're prone to forget about, about kindness, about compassion, about investigation. How easily we're prone to forget because of the power often of habit patterns. So actually, here we're putting in the conditions that are actually really constantly helping us to remember. Helping us to remember, and that's what is inclining the mind towards awakening. I mean, this is a huge challenge for us, I think. We don't live in monasteries. We don't have the protection of, cloistered walls. We're very much in the midst of a life and a world which is, sometimes really supportive of understanding and compassion and sometimes not, And actually, the more that we actually kind of learn to navigate through that world, which we are part of and contribute to and learn from. But the more we actually feel like we have a path of navigation in that world, the more helpful it actually is in terms of helping us to remember and inclining the mind towards awakening. This is a very conscious cultivation, actually, of the skillful and the wholesome. Mm-hmm. So this first foundation of mindfulness, I mean this first element, this first of the four elements of mindfulness, of wise attention, this is something I think we do our best to actually cultivate this in every moment as a guardian of the mind, you know, as a guardian of the mind from the surges of impulse, habit, beliefs, clinging, craving, aversion. This is actually so crucial. So it's often said that these four conditions, they not only incline the mind towards awakening, they foster a climate of heart conducive to transforming insight. In a way, it's what keeps us close to the stream. Yeah? It's what keeps us close to the path. As the Buddha once said, a person associating endlessly with the unwise and foolish has as much chance of tasting the Dharma as the soup ladle has of tasting the soup. And, you know, this kind of, the imprint that comes in, you know, is in that very sort of simple but such core teaching that what we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes a shape of our mind. What we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. So wise attention, or we might say almost these four conditions, they're a way of actually secluding the mind. You know, a way of secluding the mind. You know, George Eliot, mentioned this in a talk the other night, spoke about, you know, we hunger for the good and the beautiful. You know, we hunger for the good and the beautiful. And this is a hunger too important to forget. You know, and reminding ourselves of the good and the beautiful. I think there is an undeniable ethical aspect to both the realization of stream entry and the path of stream entry, that nibbana is often characterized or defined as the blowing out the fires of craving and aversion and delusion, which actually are the source of all unethical actions. And although there are suttas very much that speak about going beyond good and evil, what they've gone beyond is the identification with virtuous and unvirtuous acts. Now, nibbana, I think, as the Buddha describes it, has some very profound ethical implications. You know, it says that an arhant, one who's fully awakened, is completely unable to commit a breach of ethics, since those breach of ethics are actually rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. So, I want to just kind of sum up this part, this first phase of stream entry, the characteristics. So the characteristics of stream entry realization is a commitment to a natural embodiment of ethical guidelines. The dissolution of personality view is the dissolution of clinging and grasping. It's understanding the teaching of fabrication. It is also a manifestation of metta. There's a cessation of doubt. There's no doubt about tasting freedom and entering the stream. There's the ending of the attachment to habits and rites and rituals. The cessation of clinging to personality view, no longer bound to all the busyness and agitation and doubt of me and mine. And it's often said that characteristic of stream entry is that there's no falling into hell realms. This is not about talking about some future life. There's no longer falling into the realms, inner realms of inner torment, born of clinging to me and mine. So what we do here, and I think this is a way of reframing one's own practice, what we are actually doing here is we are practicing for stream entry. We're practicing for stream entry as we begin to explore this map. And we practice that with confidence, with confidence. Now, the stream enter, it doesn't retire. It doesn't retire into some sort of illusory enlightened retirement. It doesn't go out into the world proclaiming I'm a stream enter. You know, it's so clear in the whole of the Buddha's life that after his awakening, he continued to carefully examine what was arising in his heart. He didn't put his cushion into cold storage. The Sotapanna has entered the stream of the Eightfold Path. There is a fading away of craving and ill will, but it doesn't mean they don't arise. But the primary realization of the stream entry profoundly affects and informs how these residues and traces of ill will are seen and responded to. So the cessation of personality view means that these residues are not seen as mine, not seen as something to work on. There is no feeding of them, there is no grasping of them, there is no identification with them, and there is the beginning of their fading. The beginning of their fading. Okay, that's what I actually wanted to cover this morning. So, any questions before we have a sit-in before lunch? Any reflections? So it's all perfectly clear. Yeah. Could I repeat the last part of that? Stream entries don't retire. There's not a sense of, you know, enlightened retirement. There's not a sense of going out and proclaiming in the world. You know, I mean, if you look at the Buddha's life, you know, it's this ongoing investigation. I mean, if you look at the body of texts, you know, Buddha got up, you know, after the Bodhi tree, gave the discourse on Four Ennobling Truths. But if you look at the body of text, the subtle tips, understanding was a product of his ongoing investigation. He didn't just have one song, you know, a remarkable comprehension. So this ongoing investigation, so there's the entry in the stream means that actually there's a cessation of personality view, belief. There's a cessation of doubt. It means that they don't come back. It's not like they're latent. They actually don't return. That's what's actually meant by unshakable understanding. They actually don't return. There's a cessation of the tendency to attach or to cling to habits or to rites and rituals. These have actually ceased. They've gone out. So this is actually why it is such a sort of profound understanding, because it's not a temporary suspension. These are gone. They're gone. It doesn't mean that there is the end, you know, because this map is a map of actually gradually falling away from actually the most obscuring tendencies, such as personality view, to actually, again, the more subtle. So the Sotapanna is actually really still on this path and actually really embodying this Eightfold Path, but the traces of craving and ill will and other obscurations arise, but they are seen differently because they are not me, they're not mine, they're not a project to work on. They're something to be understood, but what is really happening here is the cessation of feeding. And you know, in everything in this life, what you don't feed fades. What is not fed fades. You know, and actually what is often leading to feeding of the unhelpful is, of course, that it's who I am. It's me, or defines me. So, and I've got a lot of projects to work on. It's I think, why, you know, we talked about yesterday, this reorientation from working on, doesn't mean being irresponsible, you know, not working on my issues, doesn't mean being irresponsible or not taking care or not endeavoring to understand, but it's so much working on, you know, can be a disguised effort for an improved personality view. And I think we actually need to be so careful. And I think there's even questions, you know, when the mind is flavored at all by what we're working on, even the kind of attention we give becomes implicated in feeding what we're working on. I think it's why things feel so stuck sometimes. Because they're being fed even to the kind of attention that's being given. And that doesn't mean not giving attention, it doesn't mean ignoring, doesn't mean dismissing, but actually as far as I can tell from the early texts, you know, cultivating the skillful and the wholesome is actually going to do that relinquishing, and not as a product of my efforts to work on something. Yes.
Are we not in the stream until the has ceased? The cessation is happening. We're still on the bank until we build our raft. Otherwise, we drown.
Yeah, we built our raft, but we're not completely in the stream as long as these are operative. In this particular map, we're certainly on a path. But the sotapanna is actually absorbed in the path. There is no choice. This is the path that's being embodied. This is the path that's being embodied. Okay? So with the cessation of those first obstacles or obscuring forces, this is now the stream that's being embodied. So the sotapanna is one who's entered the stream. You know? So a lot of time spent dipping our toes in and deciding whether we really want to go there or not, you know? Or whether the raft is strong enough, or all of those things. But remember the hands and the feet bit.
I'm assuming it's deep water.
Remember the hands and feet bit. Well, the blame is already a narrative about them, isn't it? It's already a fabrication. I mean, I think it is very important that we all have sufficient clear comprehension to actually know that we are the children of the conditions in our lives, you know? And it's very important to have sufficient clear comprehension to know actually how we ended up where we are right now, with our views of who we are, with, you know, all of the past experiences and narratives that's been told to us by others. So there's never, you know, I think people without that clear comprehension, I just end up confused, you know. But it's actually really, you know, in a sense, that awareness of clear comprehension, that awareness of the conditions in our lives, actually that has a big effect in taking away the blame, you know. Because, you know, where do those conditions begin, quite frankly? You know, I can say, you know, I had a really angry father, you know, who's had a really impact on my life. But, you know, where did that begin? You know, we could go forever. We could go forever. But enough clear comprehension to know what has actually really played a part in shaping our view of self, our view of the world, our view of others, you know, the struggles that we engage in. But, you know, quite frankly, that doesn't have to be a really big story. You know, it doesn't have to be really... And then what we're left with is the present moment experience, okay? Then what we're left with is the present moment reenacted. enactment and reenactment of those of other conditions that keep those past conditions in place. So it's then the present moment experience when personality view appears, when doubt appears, when attachment to habits appear. That's what we're left with, and that's actually where we're going to actually bring wise attention. That's when we're going to investigate. That's when we're going to actually learn to stop feeding the fires and learn to bring other conditions into place. You know, I mean, the Buddhist conception of healing is very different, I think, than many conceptions of healing, that, you know, we heal the past through healing the present. You know, that we don't heal the present through healing the past. We heal the past through healing the present. So we're bringing into the present moment the conditions of mindfulness, the conditions of compassion, the conditions of wise attention, the conditions of listening to the Dharma, the teaching, having a pathway. We're bringing those conditions into the present, which is completely different than feeding the conditions that keep the past repeating, repeating, repeating. Well, I think this is why the Buddha talks about Sangha. You know, we need to learn to inspire each other. And sometimes I think we do need to learn to, you know, we're also all children of our practice environments. You know, I've been in many practice environments in my own life, you know, my own training. And, you know, I sometimes I'm aware of how much I absorb those practice environments and form a particular view of practice, you know. And it can be, you know, it might be a very therapeutic view of practice, you know, where actually I'm encouraged to work on things. You know, there was a time in my practice where that was certainly true, you know, where I was a really good worker, you know. Unfortunately, the list never got any shorter of things to work on, you know, which is actually really a good insight. You know, the list doesn't get shorter in the work orientation. But this is why it is important to keep having, you know, investigation and other perspectives. Now let me explore what it is to orient myself, for example, towards cultivation rather than eradication. You know, that's a huge shift for many people. You know, it's like major, you know, cultivate the lovely, the healing, the liberating, you know. Practice insights. Practice insights, you know, rather than this kind of like what is, you know, insights are supposed to be the result of practice, rather than what I practice, you know. That's huge, you know. It took me a while to hear that, you know. Oh, this is actually something I practice. Practice is not just about sitting down watching my breath or observing my body. I'm actually learning to practice insights both on the cushion and particularly off the cushion, you know, particularly off the cushion. I learn to practice insights. So one has to actually, you know, have to understand that we're, you know, we're in an unfolding process, you know, and the willingness to learn. The willingness to learn. I mean, you know, we have a strange, very strange thing, I think, in Western Dharma, you know, that we actually don't talk very much about liberation. You know, we don't talk very much about nirvana. You know, it's almost like it's an embarrassing subject or something. It's whereas, actually, I think it's really so important to naturalize that conversation. To normalize that conversation, you know, let's talk about nirvana. Let's talk about how other people talk about nirvana. You know, let's talk about, see, look at how the Buddha talked about nirvana. You know, it's actually, you know, considering that it is the third ennobling truth. You know, it is the direction of the path. It's a pretty important subject to talk about. You know, so we have to keep learning. No, we don't go in and out of nirvana.
That's what I'm having trouble
No, we do not go in and out of nirvana, not certainly from the perspective of this teaching, that nirvana is unshakable. What we do go in and out of is understandings and places of understanding and places of habit, you know. So actually, what, you know, and this is kind of the radical piece of this teaching, is actually to begin to envisage a way of being present when some things are gone, where the belief in personality view is gone, you know, where doubt is actually gone, you know, where attachment to habits is actually gone. Now, this is really important, because this is the kind of, this was the revolution of the Buddhist teaching in a way, you know, was actually, this is an unshakable understanding. Now, but remembering that is the fruition of a path, and in the path, you will see yourself going in and out of these understandings, you will see yourself going in and out of habit, but actually the investigation of what leads us to go in and out is really significant. Learning not to feed the outs, you know. It's all about practicing the insights of a stream entry in order to have that unshakable fruition of those insights. So it's actually called upon to practice those insights, you know, and that's what it means to be a student of nirvana. They were actually practicing the insights of awakening, as the Buddha described it, you know. I have to put that caveat on. As the Buddha described it, he gave us a roadmap, you know. He said, practice those insights, and this is where they lead, this is where they lead. And, you know, it is hard to imagine, I think, from a place of, yes, going in and out, to kind of envisage a way in which actually, that's actually blown out, you know, it's not just hiding, it's actually blown out. Of course it's hard to envisage that, but that's where I think where the place of confidence actually comes in. The stream entry, yes. I would say yes. It's not like it's a moment. It's not like flipping a switch, you know. Although sometimes, you know, some people would say this would happen in very deep meditative experience. I think others would say not. You know, if you look at the story of, you know, many of the stories in the text, you know, you look at Ananda, you know, the Buddha's cousin, you know, going, you know, being excluded from all these Arahant meetings. You know, that was tough. You know, he was the Buddha's most loyal student, you know, heard everything, you know, and all these people were becoming Arahants around him and not him, you know, it was really tough, you know. And finally he sort of gives up, you know, and goes to lie down and actually sees, oh yes, that's actually what was being taught, you know. But actually that's more unusual. That's a sudden awakening kind of, you know, metaphor. Much more, you see, it's like a cheese. It's a ripening to maturity, you know. It's a ripening to maturity, and then actually there is the knowing, and the Buddha puts this very, very clearly as an aspect of awakening, the knowledge of cessation, the knowledge of cessation, you know, the actual knowing that has gone out, it's not returning. It's not so impossible. Stream entry is not so impossible. To really, you know, you have to up your game here a little bit in terms of confidence, you know. And actually, so this is possible, you know. This is not talking about, you know, 10 lifetimes in the future. It's talking about this is possible, you know. Put the conditions in place, you know. Set your mind on the path of awakening. Practice the insights, and there are fruitions, you know. I certainly don't want to undermine the profundity of that understanding, but I also really, really want to encourage you not to put this into some realm of impossibility because I'm just a poor old meditator, you know, kind of slouching along in my sweats, you know, trying to get a breath or two along the way, you know. I mean, just don't put it into some level of, you know, impossibility. That's what doubt is. That is that kind of obscuration of doubt, you know. And, you know, as far as this teaching goes, you know, actually it doesn't mean that the doubt doesn't arise, but it doesn't mean that you consent to it.
Given the incredible deception of the mind, it almost feels like a teacher
Remember, we're talking about the first stage of awakening. You know, we're not talking about complete nirvana. We're talking about the first stage of awakening. Okay, so just very important to make that distinction. But the mind is on the path. It's not going anywhere else, you know, because that confidence is really there. No, you don't need a teacher to recognize it. If you do, you probably got doubt. But the Buddha actually said, you know, stream entry is recognized by how they are in the world. Not by a meditative experience, but how they are in the world. Because it's the liberation too. It's a liberation to embody the path. Oh, we're going into that this afternoon. Okay. We're going into that this afternoon. I mean, I just think, you know, I think it's really good just to let your mind go a little bit here and think about what it would be like for you to move through your life and to move through your day without personality view. And to, you know, what would that look like? What would drop away with that? You know, think of all the kind of think of all the misery that would drop away. You know, the self-narratives and the craving and the comparing and the judging and, you know, the craving to be calm and all the work and, you know. I mean, it's really important just to think of, you know, what would drop away with the belief in personality view. Just think of all of the misery that is optional, that would just drop away. You know, and we have little tastes of that, don't we? Because we have little tastes when personality view is just not operating, you know? Where the I am is not operating. And those are the moments of peace in our lives, you know? Those are the moments of sensitivity. Those are the moments of spaciousness and wholeheartedness and relatedness, you know? We have those moments to build on, and they are not moments of misery. They are the moments of aliveness. So, you know, this is a really good incentive. You know, it's a really good incentive to, you know, even though the doubt may be present, you know, and you know, the kind of habit patterns seem everywhere, you know, you have to really, when the Buddha talks about the end of dukkha, you know, there's not some sort of vague concept, you know. It's actually really the misery that can be experienced on a daily basis, you know, that comes with the package of personality view. You know, it's not an add-on misery, you know, it's actually the misery on a daily basis that comes with the package of personality view, that this is actually what is falling away. You know, if we needed more incentive than that, I have no idea what it would be. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we all find that we have a different energy level when these things fall away. I mean, think about how utterly exhausting self-doubt is. You know, and there's nothing more tiresome than personality view. You know, think of the exhaustion with telling that story over and over and over and over again. You know, I mean, it makes us so busy trying to keep our world under control through our habits, you know. I mean, there's just so much to do there. Of course, there's going to be a different energy level when that drops away. You know, we live in an exhausted culture not because of external doing. I think we live in an exhausted culture because of so much internal doing. Dukkha is really tiresome work. Oh, you know, it's good to appreciate that. So I'd like to suggest maybe we take 5 minutes just to stretch, and then we'll have a short sit before.